of four planned public hearings were held this week on possible changes to COTA's downtown service. The possible changes are favored by the city. A 2010 update of the city's downtown development plan envisioned a transit center, for example. COTA officials feel a little bit differently about things. Joining us today to explain the proposed changes and COTA's point of view is COTA President and CEO Bill Loda. Welcome to the show, Bill.
Thank you, Ann. My pleasure to be here.
Question to our listeners. Are you a bus rider? Do you travel downtown? And do you care where the buses park and pick up? Give us a call if you want to talk about that issue. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. And Bill Loda is just going to be with us for the first segment. So get the calls and the emails in early. Bill, there are two potential changes on the table. One would relocate the bus stops mostly from High Street to Front Street, and the other would create a transit center to consolidate all the downtown bus stops. Let's talk about relocating the bus stops first to Front Street. What does that involve?
Okay, well, yes, and as you know, the city's plan did recommend the construction of a transit center. And we had not looked at our routing downtown in a number of years, so we commissioned the study that is on our webpage, COTA.com, to look at alternatives. They looked at nine alternatives, put those nine alternatives through various filters, and did arrive at the two recommendations to be considered in the public meetings, which were, as you point out, the Front Street option and the transit center. The Front Street option is an option to relocate some of the coaches that currently use High Street to Front Street. So it would not be taking all of the buses off of High Street. It would be taking a portion of the buses and moving them over on to Front Street. This will require the relocation of various lines yet to be determined. There are some recommendations in the report of the lines that we look at, but we would have to carefully study those to see if it can be done. Now, a couple things that would need to happen in advance of a full Front Street option is that Front Street would have to be made two-way north of Broad Street. As most of your listeners, I'm sure, know, it is currently two-way south of Broad, but we would have to have it made two-way north of Broad, essentially clear up to Hickory Street, which would make it two-way all the way up through the Goodale Park area. Mm-hmm. And that would allow the coaches then to use Spring Street to reach Front, south on Front to Main Ridge, go back then east at one of those streets. So it is a relocation. It is additional expense, and that's a key component of what we're looking at. That Front Street alternative would require us to expend on an annual basis somewhere between $1.2 and $2 million.
In addition?
In addition to our current operation.
Why would it add expense? I get maybe one time having to make the changes, but why would it add so much?
It will add the running time to the coaches on those lines. And as running time is added, that is additional expense. And if the running time is more than de minimis, it can, on some lines, result in the addition of a coach on that route. And when you run these vehicles, particularly the lines we're looking here, 7 days a week, many times from early in the morning till late at night, that adds a lot of expense. And the report, it's outlined in the report that it's $1.2 up to about $2 million in additional expense. And that's a key point that prudent business people have to think about, because we're adding expense, but we may not be adding additional revenue. And most businesses work hard to reduce their operating expense, or if they increase their operating expense, they want to see a commensurate or more increase in their top-line revenue.
My guest is Bill Loda, COTA President and CEO. If you have a question or comment, we're talking about downtown right now. There are four public meetings have been, or public hearings have been planned to talk about possible changes to COTA's downtown service. Two of those public hearings have already taken place. Bill, what have you gotten from the two public hearings that have occurred already?
Generally, the concern is from users of our service that they're concerned about the additional time on the coach and the additional walking distance that they may have to take if they're working, say, in the Rhodes Tower and their line gets moved to Front Street. They have to walk an additional block. They have to navigate the hill that comes up from Front Street, essentially on Front Ridge Main streets. And we're particularly concerned about the disabled community of are they able to navigate that hill. So the general consensus, I would say, is concern with the additional inconvenience to our customers. There have been one or two that are in favor of the transit center as well, but generally I would say it's more concern by your users of our service of the inconvenience that they may have to experience.
The problem with having the buses on High Street north of Broad there, it is because it creates a wall of buses for much of the day. And the businesses located along there say it's hurting their business. Now, some people might say, well, it's good to have a bus stop because people are getting on and off the bus right in front of a business. And if it serves, you know, people, you know, if that kind of a business, then they could benefit. But are you sympathetic to what their concerns are?
Well, we want to be a good corporate citizen. We're an integral, viable part of downtown. We provide a valuable service. I might add, we provide a service that's growing about 9% annually with additional riders. In fact, just before your show, I got our latest statistics on ridership from last year. In our current week, we're up 9%. Year-to-date, we're up 8.3%. People are seeing public transit as a viable alternative. They're trying it. They like it. They continue to use it. So we're bringing a lot of folks to jobs. About 60% plus of our riders are going to and from work. So they are customers. I think it's debatable whether buses are detracting the return of retail downtown. I am certainly a huge supporter of a vibrant downtown, more retail. We want to do our part, and if we can do it prudently, we want to certainly see if we can distribute our buses a little bit off of High Street. But if you go back in, there's been public transit on High Street since the Civil War, right, when some entrepreneurs took a horse-drawn carriage and transported veterans from the Union Station down to the State House area, and we have seen vibrant retail on High Street. I vividly remember my years in college of going down to Lazarus and the vibrancy in the crowds. Mm-hmm. We want to see that again, but there's always been public transit there as well. So it's a delicate balancing act that we want to be part of. We want to do our part, but we got to remember we're funded by the taxpayers, and we have to spend taxpayers' dollars prudently and make sure that we're giving them a good return as well.
There's also the proposed transit center, which could cost tens of millions of dollars. Tell us about that and what your concerns are about that.
Well, the transit center is the second alternative that's being discussed in the public meetings, and that is to construct a transit center that would be between Gay on the south, Long on the north, High Street on the east, and Front Street on the west. Now, not the entire block, but in that block, which mm-hmm. primarily is now a parking, the proposal was to build a transit center to have a place where people could transfer from one line to another.
All of the downtown buses.
Well, essentially all of the downtown buses except northbound buses on High Street would not go into the transit center. But primarily all the coaches would go into the transit center. It would provide a place to transfer. It would be conditioned, cooled in the summer, heated in the winter. Would certainly provide amenities for a transfer site, but that option would cost COTA somewhere in the $5 to $6 million annually operating, both for the additional cost to route the buses into the transit center, as well as the operation and maintenance of the transit center, and about $20 to $40 million in capital cost. And we don't think that it is a prudent expenditure unless we can show a commensurate return on that investment. Because we got to remember, for every dollar we spend additional service, that's a dollar we don't have to provide service someplace else. And that's why we have to look at these trade-offs.
Charlotte in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Ann. Thanks for taking my call this morning.
You're welcome.
I'm a COTA rider. In fact, as long as I'm in Columbus, I don't own a car, so I either have to get places on COTA. I'm not thrilled with any kind of rider center. Columbus is not Chicago. They don't run the buses every 15 minutes here, so that if I miss a connection all the way from Graceland Shopping Center from my job and I have to get to the southeast side and I'm running a second shift, if I miss that connection, I have to sit there for another half an hour to an hour. And so I'm not thrilled with that nonsense of a bus station. The other thing is, if this is really code language for the fact that some of the downtown merchants aren't thrilled with the socioeconomic spectrum of COTA riders, I can understand I'm not too thrilled with people being allowed to loiter around bus stops either, especially when I'm traveling there alone at night on my way home. And indeed, I was there late one evening last winter when I actually witnessed a Federal Express van drive off and lose a package behind, and for lack of police coverage at Broad and High at 9 o'clock at night, I had to wait until my next bus came, hop off in German Village, run to the Giant Eagle where I knew a special duty policeman would be on duty to report the fact that people had taken that strong box and were sitting there bragging about taking it home and popping that sucker open. Okay.
Okay,
so then from about a mile away, when it was safe for me to hail the police, I was able to get the police on there. So I can understand local merchants being upset about that crowd of COTA customers.
Okay.
But if they want to invest $5 million, what they need to invest $5 million in is getting the routes going more frequently and getting those extra buses on so that people don't have an excuse to loiter and to get into mischief while they're down there.
Okay. Thank you, Charlotte. Any reaction to that, Bill Loda?
Well, first of all, I'd like to commend that customer for taking positive action of seeing something and doing something. But that's a general theme that we're hearing, that if we're going to spend that kind of money, are we better off putting in additional service and more service, more weekends service, later service, than putting it in a transit center?
We have an email from John with another point of view. He writes, virtually every other city makes a transit center work. Why is Columbus always different? Can people really not walk an extra block or two? I have lived downtown for 3 years. I noticed after a while that I completely avoid walking on High Street. It is due to the huge bus lineups, fumes, and crowds blocking the sidewalk. What business owners would ever want to locate there? Until something is done, High Street will continue to suffer. So that's a different point of view, but the point he makes at the outset, virtually every other city makes a transit center work. Is there any template out there, Bill Loda, for what they're proposing?
Well, I would challenge that statement that every other city has a transit center. That is not an accurate statement. There are some who have transit centers. There are some who work. Nashville is one that is often mentioned. They have a downtown transit center. But I've been at the transit center in Charlotte, and it has some issues with it, but it is a transit center on the edge of downtown. So there are transit centers, but one thing that's unique about Columbus is that our downtown is very, very long north and south and very, very narrow east and west. We are not a compact, square, nine-block square downtown. Cincinnati is somewhat like that, more compact. We're very long, and therefore there's not a place where you can have it right in the center and everybody can get to it.
Some people have to walk farther than others.
Some people have to walk farther than others, no question about it.
Bill Loda, thank you for joining us today. Appreciate it.
Could I just correct one? I said that the northbound buses would not go into the terminal. It's the southbound High Street buses that would not. The northbounds would. But I really appreciate your time.
No problem. Bill Loda, he is COTA president and CEO. We're talking about the proposals to change how COTA's downtown service operates. We'll put that link, COTA.com, on our website at WOSU.org if you want to check it out. Coming up, Ben Gelber to talk about the weather. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
This is 89.7 NPR News. Receive daily updates from WOSU by liking our station on Facebook or by following WOSU News on Twitter. Another way to connect with us is by subscribing to our Daily News Loop e-newsletter. Visit WOSU.org/email to sign up.
Support for 89.7 comes from Antioch University Midwest, helping working adults complete their bachelor's degree by offering 7 broad BA programs, including management and sustainability. Details at midwest.antioch.edu.
Sunny and hot day in central Ohio, a high of 97 today. With the heat index, it could reach 109 degrees. Partly cloudy tonight, a low of 78. There's a chance of a pop-up shower or thunderstorm in the afternoon for Friday. Another hot day, sunshine, and a high of 94. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues. This is 89.7 NPR News.
That's Martha and the Vandellas using a heat wave as a metaphor for love, but it sounds a lot cooler than the real thing, especially the heat wave that has gripped Ohio for a week now. And we're not alone. The Associated Press reported yesterday that 17 states have issued heat warnings like Ohio. Joining us today to talk about to talk us down off the ledge, I guess, is NBC4 meteorologist Ben Gelber. Ben, welcome back to the program.
Hi, Ann. How are you?
Very well. Questions for listeners or question for listeners, is the heat tearing you apart? Bring us your ideas for survival and questions for Ben Gelber. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Ben, when we called you yesterday to see if you could join us today, you said, well, yes, unless there was a storm. These pop-up storms, are they taking you by surprise as well?
No, they're in the forecast, and I think it's more of a question of warnings. And we get you get the initial round of pop-up storms, and they show up pretty well for the most part on both our computer models, and also we can surmise based on expected temperatures and humidity and maybe the presence, like yesterday, of a weak frontal boundary just kind of hanging around. But you can't pinpoint hours and hours in advance exactly where pop-up storms will occur unless there's something really well-defined. So you have to kind of broaden out your approach. But then once they develop, they take on a life of their own. And that's where, especially this spring and summer, I've had to babysit radar deep into the night. Our days start maybe at noon or 1 o'clock, and you leave at 3 or 4 in the morning because these storms, so once they get going, then you have to track them individually and collectively. Some may remain, and most usually do remain, sub-severe, but you never know, one or two or sometimes a whole line of storms can suddenly reach that threshold where wind damage can occur or hail damage or, in worst-case scenario, rotation, and then warnings start to pop. But as to which cell at the beginning of the day is going to be the one that is problematic is not really possible to tell because they evolve and collapse and the new ones form and feed off cell mergers and things like that. So, yeah, the problem is just knowing that there'll be a few storms around is one thing, but you still have to kind of watch the game evolve and then be ready to get the warnings on them. We, in fact, did have one thunderstorm warning last night from the various cells, and that actually was a light end event compared to, say, Monday evening and the previous Monday when we had many, many thunderstorm warnings. And that's been the, you know, the pattern over and over again this spring and summer.
My guest is Ben Gelber. He is NBC4 meteorologist. If you have a question or comment for Ben, 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can also go to our All Sides with Ann Fisher Facebook page and post your question or comment there. So the U.S. is experiencing a heat dome. What's a heat dome and how can we get rid of it?
Well, we can't get rid of it. It's going to have to do that on its own. But a heat dome is basically a huge bubble of hot air. It may extend over 1,000 miles in scope and in all directions. And it's what we call, in weather parlance, an upper-level ridge. Basically, it's a broad area of high pressure, not at the surface alone, but all the way up into the mid and upper levels of the atmosphere. So over a huge area of the country underneath a heat dome, the air is sinking, and subsiding air warms by compression, and that raises the temperature and dries out the atmosphere. And then with these heat domes and drying soils, you get a self-perpetuating drought situation, which is compounding problems across the southern third of the country in particular. So, you know, the heat just goes on, and these heat domes or bubbles are hard to burst. You need usually a fairly strong incoming wave, usually a Pacific wave this time of year, a disturbance that kind of cuts through the ridge and kind of bats it down a little bit. And then we get a few days reprieve, but the soils are dry to the south, and that means all the sun's energy goes into heating the ground, which then in turn heats the air and us. And so that's how it becomes a cycle that it's hard to break. So the heat is so pervasive, you know, it's just hard for any system to penetrate. And even when a front does encounter a hot, dry air mass, there's not a lot of moisture to work with. Now, what has probably helped us a little bit up here compared to the southern states is we had a, you know, record wet spring. So we have a lot of soil and especially subsoil moisture. So we do, you know, that takes it. It reduces the potential for 100-degree temperatures, but it's kind of it's offset by the fact that our humidity is atrocious, and by the same token, we get these frequent thunderstorms because of the water cycle. So our situation is a little bit different than the southern states, but broadly speaking, we're now all under this heat dome, the plains, the east, the south, the southwest, and it's about as expansive as these things get. So it's going to be a tough heat wave to break.
Is it in the typical range still or not?
We have to remember that we do get these heat waves just about every year. But what's different this year is the severity of the heat across, again, the southern states, where 14 states are in extreme to excessive drought. So, you know, if we're going into a summer, we actually expect on average in Columbus about 15 days of 90 degree heat or higher, and number of days with very uncomfortable humidity. And that's just a normal garden variety summer at this latitude. But, you know, just to our south, the heat has been absolutely extreme, you know, 45, 50 days over 100 degrees along the Red River Valley, Texas-Oklahoma border, and temperatures frequently popping up to 110, 112. And, that, you know, you might expect that in Phoenix, of course, but not so much and not so consistently in particularly Texas, Oklahoma, and Kansas, and at other times, you know, kind of wafting east and northeast up into Missouri and over to Georgia and so on. This is atypical because not that an individual heat wave, that may be normal, but to see this kind of expansive heat and persistence and the fact that it started in May in the southern plains, yeah, this is going to be one of the borderline historic hot summers.
Ryan, you're on the air with Ben Gelber. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Ben. Hi, Ann. I had a question regarding climate change. And my question is, you know, a climatologist predicts that with rising CO2 concentrations, we're likely to see more extreme weather events, such as heat waves. But then there's also this difficulty of attributing any one event to increased CO2 levels.
Right.
So, you know, Ben, I know that you're a meteorologist, not a climatologist, but nevertheless, do you think that, you know, these recent extreme heat wave events point to the types of changes that we're likely to see in the decades to come?
Well, that's a good question, and something of an open-ended question. In other words, I don't know that anyone can answer. Some people may feel they can answer that. I think there is a certain level of uncertainty. You're right in pointing out that no single summer or even a cluster of hot summers, same with winters or years, tells us much of anything, because that's well within the realm of natural variability. If you look back at historically, there was an article in the New York Times yesterday on the fact that we need to brace for, according to the author, many, many summers like this and a doubling of 90 and 95 degree days. My concern is this, and really it's twofold. And essentially my background as well as a meteorologist is that of a climatologist, because that was my specialization in school. So I tried to spend a lot of time pouring over, and my fascination is with, as Ann knows, historical weather records and regional climate change, which I think we have a better handle on than global climate cycles. Obviously, there's some good science and physics to an increase in carbon dioxide and other heat-trapping gases, raising the temperature of the planet. That's a given. We know that from historical data of all past volcanic periods that have put a lot of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, and looking at the matchup between carbon dioxide and global temperatures. And we know that our numbers have come up from about 280 parts per million to over 380 parts per million since the Industrial Revolution in terms of global carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. So there's a tendency to put two and two together and then look at a current warming trend and say, that's proof positive. Problem is, of course, there are other feedbacks that are operating in our climate system, and that throws a monkey wrench into any simplistic arguments. Just by increasing heat, you increase water content in the atmosphere, and that means more cloud cover. And we've certainly seen a wetter cycle during this regional warm cycle in the last couple of decades across the eastern and central states. And conversely, with that heating, you get what goes up must come down. So areas that are getting rising motions and more moisture and more storms, somebody else is getting prolonged drought. And that's what's happened in the Southwest and parts of California at the same time that the East and the Midwest have been wetter. And so those contrasts are all perfectly consistent with a warming climate, and that is the fear of some if the trend continues. But here's the sticky point, that a lot of this is model data, which is okay and pretty good, but no climate model can be perfect. And as good as they are, some of the more extreme predictions or dire predictions are based on climate models. And I feel we have to be a little bit more cautious, because there are other feedbacks operating, solar activity, for example, other internals, and I'm not sure that we have everything, we can ever put everything into a climate model and then therefore say, now expect a 3 or 4 degree temperature rise in the next 30 or 60 or 80 years and it's a done deal. But again, it's a very complex question, so I'm not sure that I would totally attribute, human activity to or blame that on the for example, this hot summer. In fact, I think that would be not good science to do that.
Thanks, Ryan, for that call. In the spring, it wasn't only wet, but it was a cold spring, I thought. I don't know if we had you on to correct me on that notion or not, but it seemed cold, and I wondered, wow, is it going to be a cold summer, too? Do you know back in the spring what the summer might hold for us or what the next season might bring?
Well, sometimes we get indications. Problem with that is that usually the climate systems that are what we call the forcing mechanisms, the ones that kind of tip the scales, are like an El Nino, which was a couple of years ago, or La Nina, which was this past winter, but they're usually dying out as we head into the summer, so that becomes a wash. But of course, antecedent conditions are important. Now, I think with that in mind, La Nina, the summer's followed a classic, post-La Nina pattern, and I say that meaning that La Nina, cool water in the tropical Pacific, favors a strong jet stream through the middle of the country, but very dry conditions across the southern states, which is exactly what has happened. So you get an active severe weather season and probably excess moisture in the Midwest, Ohio Valley, and interior Northeast, and you get extreme heat and drying drought conditions across the southern third of the nation, coming off strong La Niñas or strong cold pools in the Pacific. Even after they fade, you know, there's something we call atmospheric memory. Well, this has worked out perfectly. So in this case, the summer, in a sense, was kind of predictable because it is following the game plan, but that doesn't mean things always work quite that nicely or that you even have a strong signal. You mm-hmm. could have neither El Nino nor La Nina, and then, you know, arguably it's kind of up for grabs in terms of a forecast. And secondly, what I was able to say in the spring is once you have a wet spring, you're going to have a muggy summer. That's a given, again, because simply the water cycle. So my initial impression that, you know, wet springs and coming off of La Nina, when you put enough pieces together, would suggest that a hotter and more humid summer, and that's exactly what we've had, and that's what I was able to suggest on the air.
Paul in Worthington, you're on the air. You have a good idea. Welcome to the show.
Hi, and Ben, excellent show and very educational. On a terribly practical level, since I don't have air conditioning myself.
Oh, my gosh.
No, never have had, I mean, my whole life. There is a program, and I'm sure I believe it's been touted on the station before, but Life Care Alliance, and I don't work for them. I mean, I've been a volunteer in the past, but anyhow, in collaboration with the Franklin County, all the fire departments, any of them.
Mm-hmm.
I took five fans into Worthington, and the guys just rushed out. They were out of my car in 15 seconds. Go buy a new fan. You know, when you go to Kroger's, you go to Anderson's, you go to Myers, you know, mm-hmm. name your preference. You know, pick up a $12 fan or a $20 fan, new, and drop it off at the nearest fire station, any of them. Anything in Franklin County, any of them will take them, and they will see that they get to Life Care Alliance, and those people will see that the elderly, the infirm, or those who maybe have air conditioning mm-hmm. but cannot afford to run it,
right.
They will get those fans to those people. That's really the only comment I have.
Okay.
I'm just saying, hey, let's plug that because it's something you can do for under $20.
It's a good idea, Paul.
Yeah, and Paul, thank you very much, and that's perfect timing, Ann, because I was getting ready to mention, you know, we have an event today at the station, 3165 Olin Tangi River Road till 6:30, where we are doing just that. We're collecting fans and air conditioners with the Breathing Association and the Heating Energy Assistance Program for what Paul described, for those in need who qualify. But we're essentially collecting fans and air conditioners, obviously ideally new ones. And you don't have to get out of your car. You can just drop them off. We'll pick them up for you, and you just pull in front of our station, similar to our Firefighters for Kids mm-hmm. drive, and many folks attend that. So we're just up the street, of course, from the Fawcett Center, and we'll be there till 6:30. You can also make a monetary donation through 614-821. 4444. Now that's going to be our call for 821-4444. So this is, since today is certainly the worst day of the summer in terms of combination of heat and humidity, and there are many more days to come, unfortunately, based on the meteorological things that we just talked about.
Mm-hmm.
But we'll be there to do that today, and we're hoping we've had a great turnout and that this continues right on through 6:30 this evening.
Do you have something on do you have something on your website, Ben?
Yeah, everything's
that?
On the website.
Okay, we can post that.
Yeah,
okay.
Please do, and that would be great. And I've put information on my Facebook and everything else. But we'll be out there, and there's not as and to the reason why this is so important. Heat, and we don't always realize this. Heat is the number one weather related killer in the United States. I know this year is abnormal because of the tragic tornado statistics, but based on historic averages, which usually are based on the last 30 years,
mm-hmm.
it is actually heat, not tornadoes, not hurricanes. You always have one bad year for those events usually, but year in and year out, even more so than flash floods. And I think it's because it's a deceptive killer. It's not, it's hot. It's not like a storm is coming. But it's critical to check on the elderly, and there are folks who may become disoriented, who simply don't realize they're succumbing to heat stress and heat illness and heat stroke. And the numbers are very clear on this.
My guest is Ben Gelber, NBC4 meteorologist. We'll post that website on our website at WOSU.org if you want to check out donating a fan for people who need the help, and also monetary contributions at 821-4444. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
The American Legislative Exchange Council, or ALEC, is a group that brings together state legislators and representatives of large corporations to draft model bills. An archive of ALEC documents was recently leaked to the Center for Media and Democracy. On the next Fresh Air, we'll talk with journalist John Nichols of The Nation about what these documents reveal. Join us.
Fresh Air begins in 20 minutes, starting at noon on 89.7 NPR News. For as little as $60 per year, you can support our station and get some great benefits, too. As a member at our basic level, you'll receive a member card, a one-year subscription to Newsweek magazine, plus electronic versions of our airfare program guide and our e-newsletter. Support the programs you love. Sign up for a basic membership today. Visit WOSU.org and click Donate Now.
Support for 89.7 comes from the Central Ohio Trauma System, working with community partners to make Central Ohio a safer place to live. Details about joining the Columbus Medical Association Foundation and supporting the Central Ohio Trauma System are at goodhealthcolumbus.org.
91 degrees in downtown Columbus, a high of 97 today. With that heat index, it could reach 109 degrees. Partly cloudy tonight, a low of 78. There's a chance of pop-up showers and thunderstorms Friday afternoon. Another hot day, sunny, and a high of 94. All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
I hope you're listening to us from the comfort of an air-conditioned room, or at least have a fan going. My guest is Ben Gelber, NBC4 meteorologist, and we're talking about the weather, which is also one of the top regular news stories anywhere that you can find. He said heat is the number one weather killer. Actually, I was looking at something last night, Ben. It's at AccuWeather.com, predicted the effects of the current heat wave in terms of stress on the power grid, damage to roads and bridges, and lost lives could eclipse the effects of the deadly heat wave of the summer of 1995, which claimed about 485 lives in Chicago alone.
Right, and that was a brutal summer, which was notorious for the highest heat indexes that we have had in modern times, and which is, so in this case, it's a combination of heat and humidity, which is a good chance for me to mention the, we talk about both the temperature and the heat index. It's the heat index that usually triggers the excessive heat warnings and heat advisories. Usually heat advisory will go in our neck of the woods for about a temperature-humidity combination where it feels as if it's about 100, and then 105 for that combination. So those aren't real temperatures. They're apparent temperatures, but they're based on very real studies of how the human body responds what we feel when you factor in both temperature and humidity. So you could have we used to joke about the dry heat in Phoenix, which isn't always true either, but you could have a dry or desert-like heat and, say, a high temperature of 95, and it feels like 95. But you can also have a day like today where it's 95 and feels like 105 because of the moisture in the air. Now, obviously, everybody's different. We all, you know, these are averages based on, again, studies. But physiologically, what's going on is that evaporation, via perspiration is how we cool. And if the evaporation is limited because the air is already so moist to begin with, it's simply tough to lose that moisture off our skin, then the core body temperature can rise. And if it gets up too high, that can be dangerous and even potentially lethal.
You know, another thing you mentioned, feels like 95. Lots of times people forget when you shut your pet or, God forbid, you know, a child in a car and don't, you know, and think it's, you're only going to be gone for a minute, that heats up very quickly.
It does. We did a couple of good stories on this just yesterday, and I've done some in the past where you can get a pretty quick rise of 10 to 20 degrees in an enclosed car. And it's like a greenhouse, effectively, without ventilation. There's nothing more horrible than a case where someone is trapped in a car, even on a moderately warm day, let alone
right.
on excessive a day. So, I mean, if it's in the 90s outside, your car, as we've shown, will go 110, 120 degrees in the interior, and that's a recipe for disaster. The it doesn't take much to concentrate that kind of heat, and the human body simply can't cool off fast enough to compensate. And regarding pets, as my veterinarian reminded us recently, that dogs are and cats are susceptible to heat stroke just like humans. And what you want to avoid, I mean, if your dog is outside or cat, but particularly if your dog is outside, you have to realize, we're telling folks to stay in between noon and 6, so you don't want your pet outside between noon and 6 during the heat of the day and when the heat index is well over 100. You shorten the walks, and when they are outside, they have to have available shade. There's nothing worse than seeing a dog that's on a leash that's too short to get under a tree. They have to be completely shaded, and check the water bowl.
Right.
Not only make sure it's full, but also that it doesn't have warm water. It has some fresh water that's cool. Again, basics, but it can't hurt to remind folks over and over again about this kind of thing.
David in San Francisco, you want to talk about climate change? Welcome to the show.
Yeah, I sure did, and I will not tell you how cool and comfortable it is. I wouldn't want to make you jealous. I was real disappointed in your guest claiming that global warming is not human, is not being caused by humans.
I don't think that's what he said, though.
Well, it sure sounded like it to me. The idea that we could take, here in California, we've cut down something like 98% of the trees in Northern California.
Yeah.
The idea that we've taken the rivers that used to be covered over by underbrush and those cool streams are now essentially baking hot and the fish can't spawn in them anymore. The idea that we had a massive lake here in the central part of the state that was drained by Los Angeles, and there are a couple of small ponds as a result. The idea that we can take humans, without even getting into whether or not we're taking massive amounts of liquid like oil and turning them into a gas and then changing the weather patterns for the world, the idea that humans are not responsible is preposterous. But then this Rupert Murdoch hacking business is getting into whether or not he was responsible for last year, the discussion about whether the climate scientists had doctored their evidence and were claiming that climate change was false based upon fraudulent documents of scientists, that can quite likely now be attributed to Rupert Murdoch hacking that data and essentially distorting it. So it's the polluters who have a vested interest in not cleaning up their pollution are responsible for global warming and climate change. And the idea that we're seeing a massive change in the earth, and that change is directly under the responsibility of polluters, and those polluters are buying Congress and buying universities and buying scientists to be able to shuck their responsibility.
David, let Ben respond to the points you're making. I appreciate it. Ben Gelber?
Yeah, thanks. David, number one, of course, I never said that human activity has nothing to do with global warming. In fact, I had just explained that human activity was responsible for an increase in carbon dioxide content from 280 to 385 parts per million, and that all historical evidence shows that a rise in carbon dioxide is linked to rising temperatures. So, for the record, that's not what I said. But all I did was put a necessary scientific caution on climate models, because I've seen such a wide range of predictions in terms of if we continue on let's say this current path of carbon dioxide output, which probably will be the case, at least for the short term, given its long residence time. But the range can be from 2 to 10 degrees of warming, which could range from, you know, incidental to catastrophic. But there, that kind of range, and with all the feedbacks that go on in our climate system, natural and human activity, you know, it's a very complex matter. And, you know, so I try to avoid the polemics and you know, I'm trying to depoliticize, you know, the argument and just, like, let's focus on, you know, what we know in terms of science, you know, in terms of natural cycles, what we know in terms of the role of human activity and atmospheric, you know, pollution, which cuts both ways. Aerosols can also reduce sunlight, and that may have been responsible for some of our cooling. Again, which shows everything has many complex branches to it. I think that the proper argument to make from David's standpoint, I mean, there are significant health issues that are associated with air pollution. That's the strongest argument to make to curb pollution. Maybe, yeah, not so much from strictly a climate standpoint, but to me, there, you know, if you show how, which is, you know, should be obvious to everyone, you know, reducing air pollution is necessary for our health, and then the nice benefit is we reduce excess carbon in the atmosphere. That actually is the stronger way to go. And coincidentally, Thomas Friedman, who writes in the New York Times and writes frequently about climate and climate change, in the past year, happened to take note of that would be, you know, a strong approach that would be what we would call, to overuse the cliche, a win-win. And that's what I've been maintaining for years. You know, let's focus on, you know, we have very strong reasons to improve the environment, always have and always should be as stewards of the environment. And I'm a very strong proponent of protecting the environment every which way. You know, and that in itself is going to bring, you know, positive climate response in terms of lowering carbon and just cleaning and dealing with some of the issues that David had said. So we're actually on the same page. And again, my job, though, as a scientist, is to kind of rein in, well, we'll say positions that are not based on good science, or just remind folks that, you know, things are far more complicated because there's a lot more uncertainty, I think, excuse me, than what some folks allow for, and that would be on both sides of the debate. I'm also a huge proponent, I just did a story on this, of reforestation, as well as improving stream quality. I've done many science stories on this in the past several years, and so I'm very clear where I stand on the matter.
Right.
But reforestation, I just did the story with a couple of top-notch OSU scientists, you know, in terms of urban trees, and you can find these on my Facebook as well, because I always post the stories, as well as NBC4i.com. You know, that removes carbon and gives off oxygen, so it's kind of an easy fix, so to speak. For, you know, it's a great approach to carbon sequestration. Plant trees, plant trees, plant trees, and obviously Ohio went from 95% forested to about maybe 10 or 20% forest by the turn of the going into the beginning of the 20th century. We've recouped that number, but there's no question we altered climate through deforestation. And I also wrote an article, an op-ed piece for the New York Times a couple of years ago on the debate on global and actually regional warming held by our founding fathers. In the 1700s, there was a very raucous debate on whether we were changing or altering climate, much like the debate today. The question was not so much, obviously we were before the industrial era, but the argument was cultivation and clear-cutting altering climate and making it either warmer or drier or more inhospitable. But it was a very heated debate, but it was held by some of our eminent founding fathers and folks from Benjamin Franklin to Thomas Jefferson and George Washington and many luminaries, names that we all recognize, were right in the thick of a great climate debate a little over 200 years ago.
Thank you, David, for the call. And I hope David continues to enjoy the temperate weather in San Francisco. We had an email for a Facebook message from Jesse. He writes, even the pool is hot, the mornings are hot, the rain is warm, the wind is hot, this is hopelessly helpless. From Kevin on Facebook, on the Facebook chat at WOSU.org/allsides, he asks, has Ben noticed that there are not any crickets this year? Is this because of the flooding during the spring? I guess that's more of an entomology question, but any ideas about that, Ben?
Yeah, I'd have to check one of my experts over at OSU, Dr. Dave
Good
Shetler.
Question.
And he's the he calls himself the bug doctor, and he would know for sure. Obviously, you know, we had excessive rains, and now we have high heat. It could very well be the because insects respond to moisture content, and we know this year was an extreme because this was the wettest spring on record in Ohio. So that has to have aside from affecting the farmers and delaying planting in some cases till early June, late May, early June. That would probably have an impact on insect population. On the other hand, it certainly increased the number of mosquitoes.
Yes.
These are all good questions, and I will follow up on that. That's the beauty of, as a meteorologist, you're also the de facto science reporter, and I get to meet all these different experts at Ohio State, Ohio University, Ohio Wesleyan, such as Tom Burns, astronomer at Perkins Observatory, when
yes.
we did a sunspot story. But from doing all these stories, I give each expert in their field a chance to enlighten all of us, and then this becomes additional topics for conversation on radio and television and when I visit the school. So there's just a wealth of good people in our academic community and with ODNR and the EPA, and we can get some real good information out there.
Glenn, we're almost out of time, but I wanted to squeeze you in. Thanks for waiting on the air with Ben Gelber.
Hi, I wanted to ask about how overnight lows are rising and also about the way records are kept. We've got records going back 100 years, but if it's my understanding, they only calculate the average for the current time from the past 30 years. So if there's a creep in temperature, it's kind of come along, but we don't see it in the newspaper.
Well, actually, these things the data is readily available. You're right. We take a 30-year, essentially, like moving averages, and partly because also some of the data in the early 20th century and before was taken at different locations. You're more apt to get a weather station in the same spot for 30 years. For example, in the 1930s, the Columbus weather station was up. It was downtown up. I don't know how many floors above the ground. So it wasn't really a good spot to measure the temperature. So, probably our best sense of average is since the state weather station got fixed at the airport in one location and has been there since the 1940s, for example. But we do look at that. And in fact, the average temperature of this past decade was nationally was a degree and a half warmer than the 1970s and a half degree rise noted in the 30-year moving average from going from 1971 to 2000 to now 1981 to 2010. And we can go backwards in time and measure warm and cool cycles. We found a warm cycle at the turn of the 20th century, and again in the early to mid-20th century, there's some very warm decades. And then we had a big downturn in temperature in the 1960s and 70s, and now we're coming back up. And you can follow this back through time. Mm-hmm. But, of course, data becomes sparse and not quite as reliable as you go back, as I often try to do, more than about 75 to 100 years.
Ben, time has become sparse. I want to thank you so much for joining us. Ben Gelber from NBC4 Meteorologist.
Thanks, Ann, and talk to you soon.
Appreciate it. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. This is WOSU 89.7, WOSU HD1, and WOSU 820 Columbus, and streaming online at WOSU.org. 89.7 NPR News, a service of WOSU Public Media. Stay cool.